To find out what's really going on behind the music, sometimes you have to dig deep. I'm Dr. Mike, and on the new season of Going There, we're doing just that.
Art or music can be your escape and your therapy.
Going There is the podcast at the crossroads of music and mental health, where we have raw, meaningful conversations with artists like Noah Kahn, Julian Baker, Jason Isbell, Youngblood, The Head and the Heart, and Bishop Briggs.
I recently heard someone describe grief as glitter, where you'll clean it up and then you'll find little pieces.
By opening ourselves up to these real discussions about mental health, we can foster understanding and gain even greater appreciation for the music we all love.
For me, like, my favorite songs give me happy tears.
So join me and some of your favorite artists on the new season of Going There with Dr. Mike, brought to you by Sound Mind Live and the Consequence Podcast Network. Subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Hey, everybody. This is Aaron Carnes, the host of this podcast. After 4.5 years of weekly episodes, we are ready to stop creating In Defense of Ska. The podcast was meant to be a promotional push for my book In Defense of Ska, and it wound up taking on a life of its own. While Adam and I both love what we've accomplished with this podcast, we both feel compelled to focus our creative output elsewhere. The episodes we recorded remain evergreen, and we invite you to explore our back catalog, which will remain online thanks to the Consequence Podcast Network. I am working diligently on a new book, a novel called Little Black Book of Death. It's not ska-related, but it has a strong musical component. I also have a punk-themed script in the works. Adam is working on new music for Omnigon. We invite you to follow our respective projects and look forward to what the future holds. To keep in touch with my writing, follow me on Substack. That's aaroncarnes.substack.com. You can follow Omnigon on their social media accounts. Thank you. All right, here we are. We have a former guest, ska icon, Victor Rice. Welcome back. Welcome back to In Defense of Ska.
Thank you guys so much for bringing me back here, especially because I was, I was really inspired by a few things that Daraka said on his episode with you guys. And it made me think that there's this whole other angle that hasn't really been discussed or even considered when it comes to, this music we love so much, you know?
Yeah, I'm here for it. I'm really interested to hear what your take is because, you know, on one hand, I think ska is kind of a small community. So we all sort of like, we're all like a community. And like those of us in different segments of the scene, we sometimes argue about our point of view, but then we also sort of come together too. But I also sometimes feel like the arguments feel like the same over and over again. So I'm always open to hear like a different take, a different sort of like perspective on this music that we haven't really gotten into before. Before we get into that, before we go behind the curtain and have this conversation, let's just kind of, if people did not hear the episode with you, we did a few years ago, which I highly recommend you go back and listen to. Tell people like kind of what you're up to. I mean, you have a history with ska in New York, but these days you live in Brazil and you're doing mostly like engineering and production work these days.
Yeah, that's it. I went to school for orchestral string bass, and that was. And my inspiration for that was that I wanted to play the bass guitar like the toy it is in the hands of people who play the upright bass. Because whenever they picked up my instrument, they just had such a command over the instrument. I was like, I want that. I want it to be easy, you know? And so I wasn't really thinking about becoming an orchestral player or even a string bass player in general. I just wanted that approach. And at the time it was 1985, and I thought, I don't think there really are any conservatories with a really long tradition of teaching the bass guitar. And I wanted a diploma with weight, not that the diploma itself mattered, but that I wanted something with some weight behind it, some history, you know, and so I wanted to take it really seriously. And at the time I didn't know what a ska was. I mean, that wasn't even on my radar at all. You know, I came from rock and I started getting into jazz, and then I wanted to go to a quote unquote real school, legitimate school. So I started studying the string bass and getting into orchestral music. So that's where I came from. When I got out of school, by then I was already a convert. I was always, I recognized my reggae roots because I was listening to my older siblings' records as a kid. And so I knew a lot about Jamaican music. And as a bass player, I gravitated towards it because it was so, you know, it's really a great medium for a bass player. It really is. I mean, mm-hmm. think of a culture that of music that, you know, prioritizes the bass, you know, that the bass is so important. And so that got me away from any kind of rock ambitions or mm-hmm. you know, or even jazz ambitions at that point. So then by the time I got out of school, it was 91 and I had already produced. Oh, that's another thing is like I was a bass player, and back in the 80s, there were plenty of studios to work in because nobody had their setups at home. That didn't exist. So it wasn't a question of me playing in great studios. It was more of that there existed this middle class of studios that don't exist anymore for making demos. You know, people who just wanted a cassette either to send to register the song at the Library of Congress or to send the demo to a publisher to see if they, you know, or an A&R department at a label to see if somebody was interested in the song, not the recording, but the song. So I got a lot of work. Since 15 years old, I've been playing in studios. By the time the Ska Flaws made our first record, I was the only one with the experience. So I wound up producing it. And I think I did a good job. I mean, I certainly did a good job with the money we had, which is how Moon Records and Bucket became interested in me working as a producer for them.
Yeah, what full do you think's circle. The most... Go ahead, for full circle real quick. This conversation is inspired by our interview with Duraka, this lead singer for The Adjusters. But you are the person that produced one or two of their records. I can't remember.
Two
of their records. So
I don't remember the name of the second one. Otis Redding Will Save the World. Is that right?
That's it. Yeah. Yeah. That was their third record. So you did not produce their first record. You produced their second record, Before the Revolution, which was on Moon. And then you produced Otis Redding Will Save the World. So
yes.
Anyways, full circle. Adam, what were you going to say?
I was just going to say, what do you think is the most important thing for a producer to do? Like, when you come in and you work on these records, what are you bringing?
Wow, great question, because the role has really changed over the years. At the time, I was in the traditional role of producer, which was somebody who was the liaison between the musicians and the engineer.
Mm.
And so I had to explain to the engineer what the musicians wanted, and I had to explain to the musicians what the engineer was capable of doing technically to make this happen. And also scheduling, rehearsing the band, choosing the engineer, choosing the studio, making all these choices, and being the person that both the technical world and the musical world could look to for some diplomacy, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like that was really my first experience as a producer. It wasn't until I started working with King Django at Virgin City that I had access to a studio without the clock running, and I didn't have to pay for my time there. And then I was able to go in there alone and sort of figure it out for myself. You know, it was me, Agent J from the Slackers, also had a key and was a official producer at Virgin City Studios. We would work a lot together. we were cutting our teeth down there. We were, you know, figuring out the simple and the complex stuff together. So, I mean, even until today, we're constantly in touch and talking about what we're doing. And so that was my first, you know, it wasn't until like 1996 that I started having my hands on the gear and started making my own and being the engineer.
Yeah.
So fast forward to 1999 and I get an offer to work at a digital studio, and I had never seen a computer before. You know, by 1999, I had made a bunch of records for Moon Sky and always with tape. But I got this opportunity to work in a post-production studio for television, and I learned the whole digital aspect of music production. And that was, you know, groundbreaking, you know, game-changing, life-changing situation. And from that point on, I've been working a lot more as a mix engineer than anything else. Mm-hmm. Not so much recording. I continue making my music and my records, and I do continue to produce for other bands. But I'd say the lion's share of what I'm doing for the last 20 years is mixing records.
Okay.
It's my favorite part of the process because I feel like that's where I can make the most difference. Mm-hmm. You know, especially now with a computer, you can really, it feels like going back in time because you can sort out things that happened in the recording session. So I, you know, with this whole editing phase that didn't exist when we were using tape, mm-hmm. It's fascinating to me. So I'm really enjoying the spot I'm in now.
So before we go behind the curtain and begin our conversation, what are a few projects just for reference, like that you've been working on for the last, you know, in the last recent year or two, you know, just like you're kind of working in different genres now?
Yes. That happened in Brazil because I was recommended to I'll call him a pop singer. Mm-hmm. His music is deeper than what we would refer to as pop. And he was interested in somebody with who had more experience with organic instruments and real instruments. And my orchestral experience wound up really helping me as far as, knowing how to, you know, knowing what instruments were supposed to sound like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So from that point on, I mean, that was like 2012. I mixed this guy's record. His name is Marcelo Camelo. He recommended me to another artist named Malu Magalhães. These are all Brazilians. And then it really took off because people started to recognize that I wasn't just a reggae head or a ska head or a dub head. I was open to other things and actually versed in other styles of music. So things really started to happen around 2015, 2016. I was working with a lot of different artists. I even got, I worked on two records down here that won Latin Grammys. So mm-hmm. I've got two of those trophies here in my studio. I should have put them up back there for some cred.
Set dressing, yeah.
Clout, you know? So then things really opened up for me. And of course, the landscape has changed since the pandemic in general in the world, but also in particular in Brazil since the regime change in 2017. So there's, you know, I'm still adjusting to that. It's never, you know, it has changed forever the way people work down here. But I think, you know, since I still work with Europeans and Americans, I still have, I'm still active in, you know, more than just Brazilian music. You know, I'm still active with, and actually the pandemic facilitated that because now people are much more used to working online. So
interesting. Okay.
That's been something that really made a difference. Of the recent years, I'd say one project I'm really proud of is working with the Soothsayers in London. they actually came down here, and I wound up producing the sessions and hiring musicians down here to work with the two band leaders who are horn players. There's Robin on trumpet, there's Idris on tenor sax. And then we had another project where they simply, you know, this was during the pandemic, they had me and the drummer, Bruno Bwark, record for their songs, and they watched us on Zoom while we were recording, and, you know, I had the sheet music, and so we made it happen down here in a studio while they accompanied us online. So those collaborations, there are a couple of them that are, you know, Soothsayers Meet, Victor Rice and Friends, and then there's a dub version of that record. That was really, I loved working on those records. You know, there's this Afrobeat influence. There's more than just reggae and ska, but they're all in there as well. And of course, for the last maybe 10 years or so, I've been working with this guy named Jorge Pensamenti, mm-hmm. who people might know the band he's in called The Loving Paupers. Mm-hmm. And I've been their fan. You know, I've been Jorge's fan for a long time because he and Dan Schneider are such an incredible songwriting team. And I've been working with them, mixing their records and enjoying their music for a lot longer than most people. And so when I finally got a chance to present a record to Easy Star, they said, this was the record called Lines. It's the one before. Mm-hmm. And they were like, we like the songs, but the production quality isn't up to our standards. And I knew what they meant because they had chosen a studio that had, they didn't have the engineer that I really like, Sean, you know, this guy in DC. I'll remember his last name. It'll come back to me. So I knew what they were talking about. And I said, you guys, next time you make a record, please, please record with Sean at 38 North Studios in DC. You know him. I know him. Just, you know, spend the money, get it nice. And of course, the songs were never the question. They're great songwriters. And now Kelly's writing as well. And it just keeps improving. They keep evolving. And that record was super easy to mix because it was so well done. Mm-hmm. And Easy Star was like, the guys there were like, yeah, now we can get behind this. So I consider that a personal victory, even though I wouldn't say I was a producer, but I was totally there from the demo recordings. And to get back to Adam's question, I think the main thing as a producer is finding the key and finding the tempo. Mm. Finding the tempo that works for the song, finding the key that works for the singer. Because when we write songs, it's easier to write a song on the piano just using the white keys. You know, so you write your song in C, you're not thinking about the key, you're thinking about the song, and you're writing it, and you're hashing it out. Or if you're working on the song out on a guitar, you're going to use the open strings. You're going to figure out something in E or in A, you know, and those keys that sit nicely on the instrument. And because the point is creating the song, not, you know, getting it on the instrument. Mm-hmm. From that point, it's important to think about the singer and who's going to be singing this and what key works for them.
Yeah.
So I'd say like, those are two crucial things, you know, tempo and key. And then after that would be, what's the beat? Mm-hmm. You know, because mm-hmm. another project I'm really proud of is my work in Budapest in Hungary with Pannonia All-Stars. It was a dream that I had for many years, and we finally brought it to reality to fuse Eastern European and specifically Hungarian folk music with Jamaican rhythms. And that was a dream that I have for a long time. And that record's called Heritage. So that's another one I'm really pleased with. Mm-hmm. plus my records, you know, Smoke, Drink. Yeah. I have the third record, you know, it's on the cooker. You know, all the basic tracks have been recorded. And I know I wanted what I want to do with it, but first I have this top secret project I'm working on down here.
Ooh,
that,
okay.
That has taken years to do, and I'm almost there. Almost there. We have 8 songs mixed. We have a 9th one possibly mixed this week. And there are 3 more that still need arrangements to be written. So I don't want to give away the instrumentation.
Okay.
But we're really excited about it. And I think this record should be in the can by the end of this year.
Nice.
So the third record, Drink Smoke, have you settled on a name?
Yeah.
There are still candidates. the only thing we know for sure about the third record is that it'll be green.
Yeah.
Because Smoke green. Is red, Drink is gold, that leaves green.
Yeah.
So the working title is The Green Album.
All right.
Nice. And then you have a cat on the red one, a fish on the yellow one. Any idea what the animal's going to be?
It depends on the title.
Okay.
And the thing about the title is it has to be both a noun and a verb.
Yes.
It has to be a vice.
Mm-hmm.
Or something related to that. Maybe not, you know, because there are candidates, you know, people have said, you know, dance, love, fuck, you know, there are definitely candidates. It has to be a word that Brazilians use for me, you know, those are the things that we, you know, when I did Smoke, I had no idea there would be a follow-up, but once there was a point A and point B, now point C has a most definite.
Yes.
You know, it's got to go a certain way, you know, and to be part of this, what I see as a package, as a trilogy.
Definitely.
All right. So let's go ahead and let's go behind the curtain. We are now, we are behind the curtain. We, so...
Thank you for tuning in for our peek behind the curtain, our conversation with dub legend Victor Rice, going deep, talking about ska. Listen, we put these special episodes out every month for our Patreon subscribers. For only $5 a month, you get these bonus episodes and a little bit extra. Every Wednesday we put out an episode, and every episode has a little bit extra that we keep for you behind the curtain. Ska now. More than ever.